Yoga Vashishta, Part 14 by Swami Surya Devananda. Salutations to that reality in which all the elements and all the animate and inanimate beings shine as if they have an independent existence, and in which they exist for a time and into which they merge. Salutations to that consciousness which is the source of the apparently distinct threefold divisions of knower, knowledge and known, seer, sight and seen, doer, doing and deed. Salutations to that bliss absolute, the ocean of bliss, which is the life of all beings, whose happiness and unfoldment is derived from the shower of spray from that ocean of bliss. The last time we spoke on two major topics, seeds for samsara and the mind, which included prana or life force and vasana or mental conditioning. Then we went on further unto unminding the mind, and we spoke on four things: spiritual discipline, avoiding carelessness, samsara, and equanimity. Our topics today include the state of quiescence, going beyond the no mind, and reality, the seed for consciousness. Let us begin with the first topic for today, the state of quiescence. A thought before we begin. When we cultivate the inner amidst the outer, action and time process become a gateway to the quiescence of eternity. Earlier, we have discussed the joy and delight of a quiet mind. Now, we're not just talking about a mind that does not work, but one that works when needed, as needed, and in the light of wisdom. And there's a big difference between these two. The noisy mind works all the time, relentlessly, often in directions that are quite different from the current activity. You could be doing something, and the mind is thinking of something else, completely unrelated, and something that may not even happen, not even take place. So it's working under the influence of conditioning, not under the influence of what is actually happening. The effort that it takes to quieten this mind, or to streamline it first, is not so much to bring about an inner silence, but to endure the wrong pull of turmoil. We are used to being scattered in our attention, and to change that and bring that into focus so that the mind's working and the hands working, or whatever you are doing, are brought together in a streamlined focus. This is the key to it. Restoring inner silence takes effort across the spectrum, not just in our sadhana area or in our yoga area or in our meditation mat or in our room. Because the mind, the same mind that we use in our prayer area or in our meditation room, is going to go into our day-to-day life. We don't have two minds as such. You may think that there's a regular mind and a spiritual mind, but it doesn't work like that. So we have to cultivate this mind in life so that it may gain depth in our spiritual practices and our meditation, and it may provide us with the deep insight that we seek. For this, the mind has to be watched relentlessly so we don't trip on its wayward functioning. For this, the inner field of activity, which is the mind and all of its movement, has to be brought in the same field of awareness as the outer. And we have discussed this the last time. See, my friends, these don't happen in two separate spaces. Where do you know all the things that are taking place outside, within the mind? Where is all this turmoil and chaos happening? This spontaneous bubbling of thought on things that are completely unrelated and probably unreal, something that may never happen. It's all happening in the same mind. So why can't it be watched together while still being able to do what needs to be done as it appears? The thing comes down to habit. We have grown used to habitually watching the conditioned mind and taking that as real and looking at the outer as something more of an occasion, but something lighter. So the inner is taken as a reality, conditioning is taken as a reality, and we superimpose that upon the outer. And in this way, the outer stops even being fun anymore. It becomes a heavy burden because we are dealing with the outer, but in light with the inner, in light of conditioning. We never see life fresh. We see the same old mind. And this is why perhaps when people talk about, their work day and things like that, they talk about it as something stressful. They'd like to get away and escape back to the weekend or on their time off, because that is something cumbersome, that is something burdensome. It's burdensome because we superimpose the burden of our conditioned mind, our habitual ways, and to be even more precise, our expectations, which is our likes and our dislikes, on what is happening out there. And this is an impossible reconciliation. You can never bring this together, and that's why it seems burdensome. So first of all, habits like what is commonly known as multiple tasking must be abandoned because they accomplish nothing substantial at all. You may think, my friends, and I've spoken about this quite a bit before, that multiple tasking and all of the other things are essential, but they do nothing but lead to a degradation of the psyche and a substantial increase in restlessness. It doesn't give you quality effort because it's only part of the mind that is being used. Part of the mind is stretched out. But when you fracture and stretch the mind out, that, my friends, is the mind you're going to bring to meditation, something fractured. How can something fractured and stressed out lead to a realization of calm oneness? Is it possible at all? No, it's going to be a mind that goes in every direction at the same time. And that is no good for meditation. Besides, you cannot do anything really well until you are 100% involved in the activity itself. You have to become the activity. That is called involvement. Your heart, mind, and body must all be doing what needs to be done wholeheartedly, all together, for peak performance. So if we want peak performance, it's not going to come by this scattered, divided, multiple tasking mind. It's not going to come with that. You're going to get mediocre performance at best, plus the price tag of a ruined psyche. Peace of mind, harmony, all of those things are going to be shattered. And you have to ask yourself if that is worth it. In doing one thing at one time, with all of your heart, with all of your mind, with all of your body, will result in better accomplishments in the outer as well as a healing of the psyche in the inner. So there's a very insightful verse right in the beginning of the Yoga Vasishtha, which goes that birds are able to fly with their two wings. Even so, both work and knowledge together lead to the supreme goal of liberation. And by work and knowledge, we have to be clear. The work we are talking about is everything we do is called work in yoga. Why? Because it's a window to the mind, to the state of the mind. When you work, when you do something, action, let's just call it action, the mind is also working simultaneously. And you can put your entire attention and mind to that work and thus cultivate the mind afresh, where it's not thinking in one direction and the activity is something completely different. So work becomes not only a window to the mind, but an opportunity to heal the mind also. The purpose of work, my friends, is to support your spiritual ascent. Work is not something different, and spiritual life and practice is not something different. I've heard it said, I can't wait for the day to get over and I'll go back and spend some time in meditation or go to the yoga class or go to the temple or go here or go there or just come into my spiritual practice. That, my friends, is a sign that something's not quite right. Spiritual life, just like spirit threads all matter, spiritual life has to thread all aspects of our life. We can lead a perfectly normal life, but in an extraordinary way, wholehearted, all together, while we are healing the mind, while we are bringing things together. So spiritual work supports our spiritual ascent. At the same time, it enables you to get things done, which is succeed in your work, and have experiences that are both positive and healthy. So yoga's definition of work is very, very different. In yoga, all action is called work. And in Vashishtha's, specifically, it's a mirror to doing because we see our reactions. So we do something and we cultivate our reactions, we cultivate our inner. The outer is an occasion to see the mind and to renew it, to refresh it, to cultivate it, to make it better, to make it healthier. So, work, and all work, is a transformer, because while being aware of our reactions, we're able to do what needs to be done. See, my friends, if we only do what needs to be done, and we don't cultivate the inner, all of our actions and their fruit are in time process. Time is going to move these things by. But we are not in time process. The body may be in time process, but that awareness that is aware of the body, that is aware of the mind, that is not material, and that is not in time process. If we can cultivate the inner while dealing with the outer, we are able to bring eternity or timelessness into the field of activity, or bring the field of activity, rather, into timelessness, because a certain part of it is going to go into timelessness. We are doing what needs to be done, but we are also cultivating the self, which is timeless. So it's a window to the soul and a window to eternity. So for this, we need to do what needs to be done on its own merit, wholeheartedly. Not on I, me, and my. Anything anchored to I, me, and I increases the anchoring to time process. And it doesn't make the fruition half as worth it. So selfishness and the ego, these are the things that are watched. And they are not given room to thrive. They are not given room to interfere. We learn to do work for work's sake, to do what needs to be done, because it needs to be done, not because it suits my interests and because it furthers my interest. And my friends, you may think, well, if I do things this way, how am I going to bring home the bread? How am I going to have a career? Just look at it. You can do what needs to be done in the workplace on its own merit. Does not things that we do have their own merit? If you are a designer, you're inventing something because you feel it needs to be done, because you feel it can be made better. If you're making something, you do it with all of your heart because you know that perhaps there's a way to make it better. If you're doing something like gardening or in your garden, you do something not because someone's going to appreciate it or whatever, but because you have a feeling that you can do it well, you can do it better. It can be done better. And if it can be done better, to do it on its basis. So work for work's sake allows things to be done and accomplished very well, but without the interference of the ego. You have to ask yourself, just why do I have to have this I, me, and my interfering in the work I do? And if it interferes constantly in the work I do, does it make it better at all? So this, all our selfishness and ego are not given to the room to thrive. We are still fully aware of them. You see the rise and fall of all of these notions, but you don't let them affect the work. So this exhausts them because they function on residual momentum. They are not getting any new energy, and they weaken by disuse, and you cultivate this wholeheartedness by full engagement. So we do what needs to be done on its own merit with all of our being, and you accomplish much more in the realm of activity and also in the inner realm, the realm of spirit. This, my friends, is the important difference between the yoga mind and the normal work-today mind. That stresses the work-today mind and just does things as they come along, disconnected from the inner. When you bring the inner, you use the outer as a mirror to the inner, and cultivating the inner gradually becomes the focus of main effort. So in doing wholeheartedly, with relentless vigilance, which is watching the inner mind, inner quiescence or quietude or the quiet mind will come about as the mind's chatter, which is the mind going in different directions from activity, will exhaust itself by disuse. Our duties are normal duties, however mundane they might be, thus also support our spiritual growth. Friends, if the inner is not cultivated with the outer, all our efforts, no matter how important you may think they are not worth much, because all we do and all we accomplish are in time process. And this is the mad rush that people tend to get caught up in. There's no harm with doing things, but there's a harm with doing things and not accomplishing much, or doing things and everything's in time process. And therefore, we're always rushing to the finish line. When we cultivate the inner amidst the outer, action and time process become a gateway to the quiescence of eternity. Friends, we now come to the second point that we have laid out for our discussion or our time together today. Going beyond the no mind. A thought before we begin. Unless one has firm resolve and perseverance, one does not come to this threshold, and it always feels like an uphill climb or struggle. We've spoken about bringing the inner and the outer into the same field of view. This may seem like a sort of doing in the beginning or something slightly unnatural because we are used to something, and that is conditioning. The inner and the outer happen in the same plane, my friends. We've talked about this again and again and again. Please bring this mind to mind again and again. I know the outer in the inner. I know the inner in the inner. Therefore, it is in the inner that everything takes place. And though it appears to be outer, that is an appearance. Everything that I can ever know, that we can ever know, that we can ever experience is in the inner. This should ring a bell real clearly that fixing things is not fixing things in the outer. There's a mad rush to do this in the outer world, to make everything cosmetic, to me. It's never going to accomplish anything, period. It's not. Until you fix the inner, the outer is not fixed, because the outer is in the process of change and it's going to continually change. We may be able to do some things, but it's going to be much more than we think that we can fix. When we fix the inner, everything comes into focus. It may not suit our likes and dislikes, but it comes into focus very clearly that things are okay. We have to bring the outer and the inner in the same field of view and sustain it. And that is the key. When you sustain it, the feeling of spatial separation, that here, out, in, all that begins to melt. When you see everything in the same space, the boundaries between outer and inner begin to melt, begin to thin down. And the psyche begins to heal into a state of oneness. When this happens, my friend, a great relief comes to the mind, because all of our stress is a conflict of the inner with the outer. What I like or what I want or what I prefer is not happening. And what I don't like, what I don't prefer, seems to be here to stay. I cannot reconcile the inner with the outer. All of our problems, all of our worries, all of our concerns, the whole mental baggage operates on this, the inner and the outer. And we fail to see that the inner and the outer are known and experienced in the same plane. Therefore, to heal that first should be our first order of business, should be our focus of main effort. When this starts happening, gradually, all notions such as this is desirable and this is undesirable are given up. Because desirability that we see is not in the objects, it is in the mind, it is in the beholder. It is in the mind that beholds. It is in the mind that says, I don't like this, and therefore when that happens, there is unhappiness. The mind makes the rule, and then the mind experiences the fruition of its own rules. We don't get upset by what is happening. We get upset by a label that is superimposed on whatever is happening. And so when something happens, the I don't like what is happening is not about what is happening. It's about the I don't like. It's about the I. And so when we address the I, we can do what needs to be done as it happens, wholeheartedly, joyfully, without all of this turmoil. A silence comes about to the mind, because when all these notions such as this is desirable and this is not desirable are given up, the mind becomes quiet. The mind's noise, my friend, the things what we call stress, are this much only. What I like is not happening or is not sustaining, and what I don't like seems to be here to stay. How could I change this? That's worry, that's stress, and that's all of that. So in this resulting silence, the inner intelligence begins functioning, or it functions in an unconditioned manner, without that I like and I don't like. When we get rid of that baggage, we discover a new mode of functioning, which is called unconditioned functioning. And this state is supreme quiescence or quietude. Vasana, see my friends, vasana or mental conditioning. Vasana is mental conditioning. This alone is the form of the mind. So when it thinks of an object, it thinks of an object on account of its like and dislike for them. That is mental conditioning, nothing else. The form of the mind taken when it thinks of certain objects. That form may not correspond with the objects. That form is our preference. That preference is merged with the image of the object, and it is seen as one picture. And that, across the series of everything in our life, is the layer of conditioning. That conditioning is not only the cause of our sorrow, the cause of our stress, but it's stress and sorrow itself. Stress and sorrow is not out there, it's in here. So when a taste for all of this, the I likes and this I don't like, why can't we live our life without them? Why can't we enjoy the things that come naturally from moment to moment? Delight in doing things wholeheartedly rather than all of this baggage that we carry around. You have to ask yourself if it's worth it. So when the taste for all of this ceases, the heart becomes clean and clear, and there is no more inner turmoil. Two things. Firstly, It takes sincere and wholehearted effort to heal the mind. You've got to be fully on board. If you are not, and we hold on to these skeletons in our closet, they are going to dance. That's it. So you've got to be on board completely, because it is not so much about quantity of effort that is required, but quality, wholeheartedly. Conditioning has got a very, very heavy force, and you may realize it or not, and the only way that you're going to get beyond it is to be wholeheartedly on board the wagon of change. Secondly, we have to find the way of quiescence while enduring the noisy mind, which is what I'm trying to say is the interim process into quietness, or a quiet mind is a lot of noise. You know, sometimes when you want to get to a place that may be quiet, the journey there can be not as quiet. There may be a lot of traffic on the road going someplace, but it's worth it, because when you get there, you're going to be in some place that you want to be, that you would like to be. So it's okay with all the traffic. Same thing with our life sometimes. When we go and work, a lot of hard work is needed to put your garden in order, for instance, or to clean your house or your place. But when you do that and everything's clean and in order, it feels good. So it's the same thing with here. The road to quiescence often involves a lot of turmoil. But enduring that turmoil by abiding in quiescence is going to strengthen quiescence, or the quiet mind. And this is going to make it worthwhile. And this is why, my friends, a wholehearted resolve is essential if quiescence is to be attained. See, my friends, inner silence is already there. We have to stop this inner agitation, or identifying with this inner agitation, to experience inner silence. And this road is going to be bumpy through its passage. There's no other way around it. It's going to be bumpy because we put too much stock in it. We've tied and anchored too much of our "this is good, this is natural, and this is normal," too much of that stuff with it. Letting go is not difficult because of letting go. It's difficult because we don't let go easily. And so the secret to this in letting go is to grab on to this quietude, to grab on to the change or the forthcoming change wholeheartedly. And when you grab on to that, there's already a letting go. There's already a letting go. You must have something to grab onto, something to aspire for, something to really want wholeheartedly, to let go. Letting go wholeheartedly is only difficult when you don't have this aspiration or something to aspire for wholeheartedly. When you're not wholeheartedly on this wagon of change, it moves slow. When you are wholeheartedly, it moves nicely. It moves quite smoothly. So, my friends, this has to be across the board. It cannot be just accomplished in our prayer area or the meditation mat. There must be this change of heart, irreversible, total change of heart, so that the quest for quietude, the wanting for this quiet, threads all the aspects of our life and living. Inner quiescence, this inner quietude, is also known as the no mind, because there are no notions in it, in consciousness, when it is restored to its natural state. Excuse me. In this, my friends, one perceives what is as it is, not according to all these pre-existing notions and all the baggage that we carry around, or according to mental conditions. And even if there are thoughts in the mind, it's not that the mind becomes thoughtless immediately. There may be thoughts, but it's just like sound in the atmosphere. When you go walk on the road, there may be a car honking, but that doesn't agitate you. That's just a natural sound of the street. So this noise that may still be there after quiescence is only there because it's exhausting itself. Let it exhaust itself out. But you discover this thing called wholeheartedness, doing what needs to be done when it needs to be done, on its own merit, or because it needs to be done, and then being able to let go, because the next thing is wholehearted. You are wholehearted in the moment, and therefore you are not anchored in the past anymore or anchored in the future. In the past by memory, and in the future by I like and I don't like, or I prefer or I don't prefer. So bring back, please, to mind the two things that we had spoken about. We spoke about the two seeds of the mind. Now, this is very important. If either of these two seeds of the mind, which is movement of life force or prana, and mental conditioning, if either of these are destroyed, both of them are destroyed because they are interdependent. Both arise from the same objects in the world. The movement of prana or life force also happens because of the objects in the world. That excitement that is felt, that agitation that is felt, is because what is out there is bouncing off what is in here. No other reason. So both are destroyed because they are both interdependent. Both arise from the objects in the world, and therefore the seed of both the objects of the world sort of become the seed for prana and vasana, because the objects of the world stimulate or give rise or motion to prana and vasana. It's not that prana does not move, but it's a steady, all-pervasive force. The movement of prana, that oscillation, is that like or dislike. That inner agitation connected to all of this conditioning. So mental conditioning and movement of prana and life force are completely interdependent. And we need to work on both of these things. A good amount of pranayama also calms the mind and brings order to the mind. But pranayama is not going to do this by itself. Along with pranayama, you have to also find a way to work that things can go on and perhaps better, while exhausting mental conditioning. When the notion of objects is abandoned, which is what we are after, we are not rejecting objects, we are not abandoning objects, but we are finding a way to carry on that exhausts the notion of objects. This is the important point. When the notion of objects is abandoned, both the movement of prana and vasana are destroyed by their root. So this is the important thing, is being able to destroy that. Consciousness alone is the seed for the objects of experience. Without consciousness, no objects can ever arise. When consciousness is in a passive state, when we are asleep, in deep sleep, there are no objects. This has been the echo of several of the Upanishads, that what happens when you go to deep sleep? They use the state of deep sleep when they start talking about this force of objects. So, my friends, there is nothing either within or without that is distinct from consciousness. When consciousness is not in play, the objects of the world are not seen, are not known, are not experienced. And therefore, it is known, all these are known as the objects of consciousness. There is a notion or movement in consciousness itself, which is known as the object. Now, we come down to this and focus on it a little bit later. This notion, all the objects in the world are notions in consciousness. This notion is a movement in consciousness itself. And this is known as object, the basis of which is consciousness alone. As long as this is not clearly understood, not just intellectually, but wholeheartedly understood, the objects seem real as something out there, disconnected from something in here. And this conflict of the outer and the inner, the object and a notion of it. The object is out there, the notion is in here. This is the conflict, and this is called samsara. everything about what the problems of samsara is, that is out there, and these are the notions that are in here, and it seems impossible to reconcile them. The removal of this misunderstanding is called liberation. So that much for samsara and liberation. Contact with the experience of objects is sorrow. The I don't like to do this and I am being made to do this. So when that notion enters the field of activity, there is sorrow, grief, turmoil experienced. The key is to continue to do what needs to be done on its own merit while being aware of the inner and letting it exhaust itself. This is the path that promotes happiness. Gradually, that which remains when there is no contact with these notions is our true nature or ourself. So this way exhaust conditioning, and what remains when all of this conditioning, all of these notions are exhausted, is our true nature, is our true self. When one has firm resolve and one lives with relentless vigilance, because this is requisite, one's practice empowers living in such a way that exhausts all these habits or the habitual ways and the accumulation of likes and dislikes. This, my friends, is the yoga way. This, my friends, is Vasishtha's way. Without likes, without dislikes, exhausting all these vasanas, continue to do what needs to be done. But don't embolden vasanas, don't strengthen them. Do what needs to be done on its own merit. When that happens, our true nature starts coming to the front. This true nature is only eclipsed by our own likes and dislikes or by our own selves. We create the mess, sustain the mess, and empower the mess that we are trying to get away from. Things outside are not a mess, my friends. They are not. Things are only a mess because of our notions of things. When we start weakening this layer of conditioning, spiritual practice adds momentum. And then the momentum of spiritual practice, along with God's grace, brings one to a level of stability in the inner march. Till we bring the inner coupled with the outer, with our practices, the weakening of this conditioning and sustaining our practices and living intelligently, till all these happen together, we are still going to be struggling in one form or another. To take out the struggle, there must be a synthesis with all of this. And for this, my friends, let's take our minds back. There must be firm resolve. Firm resolve is the price tag for spiritual progress and inner harmony, for inner balance. But not just resolve, firm resolve and perseverance. These are the two. Unless one has this firm resolve and perseverance, one does not even come to the threshold. And it always seems like an uphill climb. But this uphill climb is the hill that we ourselves have created and that we ourselves sustain and that we must one day ourselves set aside. Friends, we now come to our third and last topic or point for the day. Reality, the seed for consciousness. A thought before we begin. When you leave divisions, divisions leave you. Therefore, it is essential to always live with the thought and feeling of one pure existence. It is said that God helps those who help themselves. Self-effort is the path to grace. That is the yoga equivalent of that first statement. Self-effort is the path to grace. Towards this, the entitlement mentality runs counter to self-effort. In the spiritual path, my friends, all are entitled, but there are no free rides. These go together. They are not apart. In the free rides over there, in the entitlement, along with the entitled mentality, a free ride sort of piggybacks on it. And that thwarts the entire process. In the spiritual path, all are entitled, but there are no free rides, as what needs to be undone is within our own mind, and somebody else is not going to do it. So that is the entitlement, the free ride mentality, is that somehow if I do something, will that happen? People sometimes ask me, Swami, if I do this, will this happen? Can you guarantee this will happen? No. You are the guarantor of your own success. We have created and we sustain all the things that we must go beyond. This is quite simple. So there are no free rides because we must undo it, and no one, nothing, on no occasion is going to undo this. No amount of doing anything, whether it be a ritual or whatever, is going to undo the carelessness and callousness that has built it. Carelessness and callousness has the glue that has built this wall that must be overcome, and it is going to be undone one brick at a time, just like the way it was laid out. We are not working for someone or something else, and therefore someone or something is not going to do part of this equation for us. So all are entitled to this, my friends, not one, not a specific set of people, but there are no free rides, none at all. No, you go free and all this, all that free ride mentality has got to be thrown out of the window when we come to the spiritual life. It's hard work, and it's hard work because we are hard-headed about the things that we have to give up. It's as simple as that. You have to undo the knots in the heart and in the mind. These knots are self-caused and self-sustained, and therefore they cannot be undone, and they will not be undone by any other outer means. This consciousness cannot be tricked by any other means. There is no, if I go around this way, it's going to change something in here. If I go and do this ritual or that, this is going to change, bring about the change in the inner psyche. My friends, it's just not going to happen. Carelessness and callousness has led to this. Ongoing vigilance and relentless effort is going to undo all of this. Till the window of the mind is cleaned, one sees oneself as one is now. But when this conditioning is removed, the window is seen as clear again. As long as we have this layer of conditioning that we have created and that we sustain, things are going to appear opaque, out of focus, and a little bit confusing or stressful. All stress is in the mind that deals with things. Stress is not out there in objects, my friend. Reality is the seed for consciousness. And this consciousness arises in pure existence. This pure existence has two forms, as it were, my friends. It has the form of diversity and has the form of unity. Unity is the basis for all diversity. All diversity is experienced in unity itself. This is a big thing that the Upanishad asks us to consider. Yes, things are outside, but where do you know they're outside? In the inside. Where do you know all of this? In the inside. You can only know diversity in unity. You may know a simple example. We'll get off from talking high philosophy. We'll talk about something quite simple. Where do you know that I like this? In the same mind. Where do you know I don't like this? In the same mind. Do you experience them in a different psyche completely? There's a prefer psyche and I don't prefer psyche. Is there something like that? No. Where do we know I like this or I prefer this or I wish this would happen? Who is that wisher? The same you. Who is the wisher? Why did this happen? The same you. Where does this wishing take place? In the same mind. Where does likes and dislikes take place? In the same mind. Isn't it a moot point to have them in the first place? And to have these seeds for turmoil, ourselves create them and sustain them, our own selves? We have to ask ourselves, is it really worth it? Is it a better way? For this, consciousness has to be fully empowered, because this is going to do the battle, my friends, and we have to get on board this train of consciousness. One has to live consciously, which means in light of one's aspiration. When the mirror of consciousness is cleaned of all its impurities, diverse objects begin to be seen as diverse appearances of the same indivisible unity. When this diversity is abandoned, they have to be seen in the same unity for it to be abandoned. We cannot go straight into abandoning until we see that the outer and inner are all happening in the same plane. Diverse objects have to be seen, not intellectually, but very clearly, as diverse appearances in the same unity. For this, we need vigilant living, awakened living, alive living. When this diversity is abandoned by consciousness, consciousness begins to rest in unity, in its true nature. When one abandons all apparent divisions, and I like this word divisions, my friends, but maybe we should hyphenate it to make more sense out of it. Divisions, and we should hyphenate it like divisions. It has a funny way, divisions actually kills the vision on one sense, but it's also division is not anything but division, which is two visions of things. A wrong vision of thing, a second take which doesn't correspond with what's out there. When one abandons all the apparent divisions of pure existence and is devoted to pure existence, divisions that create confusion in one's vision ceases. The vision becomes healed or becomes one without the dye. The dye begins to die away. As simple as that. The divisions dies away and vision alone remains. When you leave divisions, divisions leave you. Therefore, it is essential to live with the thought and feeling of pure existence at all times. Yeah, there may be an appearance, there may be a thing, but that is an appearance. I know that there is A, B, C, and D only in the same mind. We have to constantly keep that. Therefore, we have to constantly watch the mind. Can we not do what needs to be done without the notions of other, of external, of separate? Those notions are not part of reality. There is something out there. There is someone out there. That the idea of otherness, the idea of otherness promotes other attitude towards things, and when that gels, that fuels up different attitudes towards different things that we have said are other, to sort them out, because the mind likes to sort and keep things sort of accessible for you, and it keeps things with these labels. Just like if you have a lot of jars in your shed or in your kitchen and they're all alike, and they all contain different things. You label them on the outside. This has got salt, this has got pepper, this has got whatever down the line. So it's easy to pick out what you want. So similarly, the mind likes to label things. So it categorizes and labels things, but it puts on that label like, dislike. This is good, this is not good. So when that happens, it's not just what's in there. We're not concerned with what's in that jar. We are completely hooked on the label that that mind has put outside. When the labeling stops, we begin to deal with things and use things as they are. Gradually, the notion of this world appearance will recede. because the seeds for its appearance are destroyed. The seeds for the appearance of the world, know of all of that is the notions that we have about them. And the entire being begins to get healed, becomes happy, and begins filled with bliss. Friends, I'd like to close with one verse from, we go back to the first chapter, I'm talking about one verse from the first chapter, which is very pertinent. It is this mind alone that is the cause for all the objects in the world. The three worlds exist because of the mind stuff. When the mind vanishes, the worlds vanish too. Now, we are not talking about coming into a state of a blank state, but it is another thing to deal with life, with all of the things that are out there, to do what needs to be done, because it needs to be done, on its own merit, when it needs to be done, to let go of it as it is done, and go on to the next thing. But we have to be on board on this. And the key to all of this is wholeheartedness. The key to all of this wholeheartedness is sincerity. Wholeheartedness and sincerity are the same thing. This is the price tag. Friends, today we've talked about three things. One, the state of quiescence. Two, going beyond the no mind. And three, reality, the seed for consciousness. Next time, we continue with the important teachings of the fifth chapter. Friends, thank you for joining me today. To download this video, its audio, or PDF handout, kindly visit suryadevananda.org. Thank you.